This is not yet an Audible production. Waiting for Clark Kent, an existential cartoon by Brad Laidman. Read by Brad Laidman. Once you rise upward through the fog of this world's black and white conformity, it is yours to conquer, explore, enjoy, and change through the sheer will and strength that was truly in your heart from the second you were brought into this world, unwilling, yet hopefully wanted, yearning with passion. Be colorful, flirt with fantasy, and fly with the utmost grateful grace. For my mother, Eve to us all, whose only selfish acts were her constant stubborn insistence on putting everyone else's needs above her own. To live outside the law, you must be truly honest. Constant rumination rarely leads the way forward in the ways of tangible achievement. You can accomplish fields of dreams in this world with the ability, confidence, certainty, hard work, and a well-defined plan. Hopefully your plan includes plain, ordinary, everyday kindness and a little looking out for the other fella too. Titans have caused havoc, built wealth, and etched their names into history without ever knowing that the only causes worth fighting for were the lost ones. My lost cause has always been my writing career, and I will fight for it until the day I die. The inaction in the comic is the action. Prelude. Clark Kent was drunk. Not actually drop-dead incoherent, then again not genuinely drunk at all. At least he didn't feel like he was drunk. Nothing would prevent him from driving flawlessly or perhaps incite him to riot. Nevertheless, on it went, drink after drink, waiting for some feeling he had been waiting for his entire life. Comparing himself with the other drunks, wishing to God to be just like everyone else, and yet not knowing how. Of course, this was all perfectly absurd. These attempts to identify with the common, the tortured pleadings to a God he knew could not exist. For how could a God believe in God? Clark Kent needed to stop feeling sorry for himself and accept the ramifications of his existence. He was perfect, faster than a speeding bullet, able to leap tall buildings in a single bound. Invulnerable to anything but loneliness. Not even the most outlandish opinion dreamed up by the ultimate zealous cardinal can come close to the reality of Clark Kent. But then, maybe just maybe, this drink would be the one. The one that would slow the man's racing mind, or at least speed up the infernally slow world around him. God, please, every man has his threshold, his limits, his inalienable human rights. At least he was alive, although Kant would dispute the point. He could breathe in the air around him, appreciate the handiwork of the Almighty he didn't believe in. The birds, the trees, the longing faces all around him, searching for what Kant alone knew they really didn't want, which was more than Lois Lane could say for herself. Silly reporters shouldn't get themselves into messes they can't get themselves out of. Why should he care? She was nearly another face in the crowd, another cog in the mass of humanity to whom he could never hope to relate. Why should he feel sympathy for someone he had never met? What if he had known her? Was he here to save the world? He couldn't even save himself. She was lucky. He'd give everything he had for such an opportunity. Why should he be sad when maybe one more drink might do the trick? Part Lone, The Birth and Death of the Small Town Savior. Chapter 1, The Blazing Two-Rocket Smallville Miracle. Jonathan Kent knew a miracle when he saw one. He'd been around long enough to know when one's prayers were answered. Surely God in all of his cruelty could not deny him a son. If a rocket ship crash landing in front of his truck rectifying the entire situation was not a personal apology from God for the inability of his loins, Jonathan Kent was finally a believer. The impossible appeared in a blazing flash from the sun. Jonathan Kent was a father. Clark was special. He would right all the wrongs. It no longer mattered that the world had left Jonathan a poor Smallville farmer. It no longer mattered that his genetic mind and body could hardly live up to his dreams. Jonathan Kent had his revenge, a personal gift from God. Jonathan Kent had a son. Martha Kent was a saint, or as close to one as Clark would ever know. She was also a born mother, and if circumstances dictated that her only child would also be her husband, it was a burden she selflessly carried. At 40, Martha had all but given up the hope that Jonathan would agree to the next best alternative of the local orphanage. She longed for someone to raise as her own, but the love bursting inside of her was doomed to lay dormant. For if Jonathan were to have a son, it would be just that, his. His flesh, his blood, the rightful inheritor of the Kent name. Clark was different, and if it meant that Martha was at last able to fulfill her birthright, she too believed with all her heart that Clark was indeed God's way of circumventing the defect in Jonathan's makeup. Clark might not have been conceived inside of her, but she would always provide him with unconditional love. The child's name was of paramount concern, and this being the Kent household, therefore, was left up to Jonathan. Jonathan considered naming the boy after himself, but he had encouraged enough juniors to realize that they were often an embarrassment to the name, a dwindling of the blood, and Jonathan Kent's boy had to be so much more. It occurred to him that the majority of great men were often named after one of their grandfathers, but it also occurred to him that credit in those instances usually went to the boy's namesake, and he couldn't have that. So as was usual in these matters of the Kent household, Martha came upon the name Clark for her favorite, the esteemed Mr. Gable, and as a solid American name, Jonathan was proud to have thought of it. Thus, records were filed 1 year late for the son of Jonathan Martha Kent, born July 4th, 1922. With perfect precision, the child had rocketed into their lives on the 3rd. Yet, as Jonathan argued quite effectively, why else would God send a child down into the heartland of America, so close to the great nation's birthday? God must have meant for him to be a symbol of their freedom. America was now the chosen land. As a lenient and appreciative man, Jonathan was willing to spot the greater being a day for the exchange of his son. After all, even a god makes a mistake every now and then. He was secure in the knowledge that he'd saved God the trouble of a flood, dire pestilence, in the rectification of such an apparent miscalculation. So Jonathan moved Clark's arrival back a day. Jonathan's belief in Clark was soon affirmed with careful kindness by the boy's growing skills and coordination. As an American, Jonathan had decided that his son would excel in all areas of sports. Although even at 2, it was readily self-apparent that Clark would rather cuddle up to a pigskin, young Mr. Kent would be Ty Cobb if his father had his wish. Clark could be Red Grange in his spare time. The ability to please his father filled Clark with abandon, but it was not an overriding passion that he long sought to demonstrate. He engendered none of the pride which his father spoke. It was simply so easy. Clark would find that pleasing people usually was. His abilities were limitless. The expectations of others, so dreadfully humble. While other children were cuddling their bats and balls, hopeful gifts from expectant fathers filled with more vision than they would ever afford themselves, Clark was running around the yard using his. He was 10 times faster, stronger, and more coordinated than the local boys 3 times his age. Even Jonathan's dreams could not have conceived of this. Even his faith in God was not that strong. Clark's age was merely a guess. For all anyone knew, he might have orbited the earth for years before landing in Martha's arms. Perhaps it was a good thing for the limits of Jonathan's mind that Clark found him so easy to please. Clark need not exert himself. Why hit a baseball 3 or 4 miles when Jonathan was so happy with 300 or 400 feet? Why run an 8-second mile when an 8-minute one was already so mind-boggling? Somehow Clark instinctively knew that his growing aptitude for flight would best be kept a secret. To Jonathan's chagrin, the boy had at least 5 or 6 more years before he can compete at an organized level. The world would have to wait. Martha knew the extent of the challenge in front of her. Clark was Jonathan's overriding passion. If she wanted a balanced and healthy son, she would have to make use of her time alone with Clark. While Jonathan dreamed in the field, she had secured a promise to let her boy live a normal childhood. The notion was disappointing to the father initially, but he soon became convinced that his son must make his mark as a man. He would not be responsible for a trained monkey. Clark would have to embody the drive to make himself great. Jonathan stood ready to be the one to instill it within his core. Amid all this, Martha yearned to give Clark love. Nurturing can be more challenging than it seems. Love for others, God, and life are either there or they are not. It is much easier to hit a baseball than learning how to love. Jonathan's teaching assignment was infinitely more straightforward, but in the end, both taught by example, and Clark was more than happy to hit a baseball for his father and love his mother. Cliched as it may seem, Ma Kent, as she was becoming accustomed to being calling, was as big on education as Pa was on sports. As Pa stressed doing your best, Ma added never show off. This boggled the young and fervently advancing mind of the young Mr. Kent. At 2.5 years, Clark could already speak better than his adopted parents, outthink them, and certainly beat them in a foot race. It did not appear all too likely that Clark that he could even figure out exactly what his best was, not to mention doing it without showing off. Clark had seen enough of life, read enough books, and heard enough conversations to conclude with a fair amount of logical acumen that it would be pretty hard for a boy not yet 3 to fly across town doing errands for his mother in a non-showy way. It didn't matter how inconspicuous it was executed. Clark decided do your best was the most likely candidate for extinction. All the evidence pointed to it. Not being showy was clearly the easiest option. When faced with the nebulous challenge of doing your best, it would cause much less commotion. Every tale the boy came across led him towards that conclusion. Each day, Ma Kent would read Clark a story meant for children. Not a particularly challenging activity is what children's story is to someone sneaking off into the closet to finish another few pages of Homer in the original Greek. Clark enjoyed being held in her soft, comfortable arms, and his agile mind found valuable lessons to be learned in each of her selections. As you can probably already tell, Clark could find little use for the little red engine that could, with all its I think I cans. If there was anything that Clark Kent did know in the world, and this would last with him for the rest of his life, if it came to something as silly as getting up a hill, there was no doubt that he could. Doing your best was just a meaningless pursuit without a worthy challenge to phone it in. Clark found much more value in Curious George. George was a poor little monkey unable to relate to an alien world not of his choosing. His only desire, the pursuit of a good time. If you can walk on a telephone wire, it seemed to Clark that you should be allowed to do so without a bunch of nutty firefighters who can't do it themselves tossing you into a cage just because some silly man in a yellow hat told you not to do it. It was something with which Clark could easily empathize. He found the same message in them all. Simple though they may have been, given his mind and situation, it was all the same. Snow White does not get woken up because there's no such serpentine secret such as those magic apples. She was likely dusted off by arsenic or cyanide, maybe something worse. Cinderella? Clark had been around enough to know that there was not any such thing as a fairy godmother. She's probably still dusting for those jealous ancient hags. He learned early that the world envied beauty, talent, and goodness. Nothing but hate and treachery was in store for those who pointed out the inadequacies of others. It was clear to Clark, if you are the loveliest, the strongest, the one with the most beautiful dreams, keep it to yourself. If that means losing the right to ever fulfill your talent, at least you would know the truth, and nobody could interfere with the strength of your reality. I'm sorry, but the rest must be paid for, because money drives everything. But this book isn't about money, it's about coming of age and discovering who you are. This was an audio sample of Waiting for Clark Kent, an existential cartoon by Brad Laidman.